dharmeshu.
In family life.
In family life.
Kuta dharmeshu.
Kuta dharmeshu.
In false occupational duties.
In false occupational duties.
Putra.
Putra.
Sons.
Sons.
Dara.
Dara.
Wife.
Wife.
Dana.
Dana.
Wealth.
Wealth.
Artha.
Artha.
The goal of life.
The goal of life.
Ti.
Ti.
One who considers.
One who considers.
Na.
Na.
Not.
Not.
Param.
Param.
Transcendence.
Transcendence.
Vindate.
Vindate.
Achieves.
Achieves.
Mudha.
Mudha.
Rascal.
Rascal.
Ramyan.
Ramyan.
Wandering.
Wandering.
Samsara.
Samsara.
Of material existence.
Of material existence.
Vartmasu.
Vartmasu.
On the paths.
On the paths.
Translation. Those who are interested only in so-called beautiful life, namely, remaining as a householder, entangled by sons and a wife, and searching after wealth, thinking that such things are life's ultimate goals, such people simply wander in different types of bodies throughout this material existence without finding out the ultimate goal of life. Those who are too much attached to family life, which consists of entanglement with wife, children, wealth, and home, are engaged in kuta dharma, pseudo-duties. Prahlad Maharaj has likened these pseudo-occupational duties to a dark well, anta kupam. Prahlad has purposefully spoken of this dark well, because if one falls into this well, he will die. He may cry for help, but no one will hear him or come to rescue him. The words Ramyan Samsara Vartmasu are significant. Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya 1951. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu very clearly explains Brahmanda, Brahmite, Konabhagyavan, Jiva. All living entities are wandering in different types of bodies throughout different planets. And if in the course of their wanderings they come in contact with a devotee, by the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, their lives become successful. Even though King Pachinabarhishad was engaged in fruitive activity, the great sage Narada appeared before him. The king was very fortunate to be able to associate with Narada, who enlightened him in spiritual knowledge. It is the duty of all saintly persons to follow in the footsteps of Narada Muni and travel all over the world to every country and village just to instruct illusioned persons about the goal of life, to save them from the entanglement of karma bandha, fruitive activity. Foundation of this criticism of so-called beautiful life, by translation, is that this kind of life is asat, or is temporary, and therefore it's defeated, because we're not these bodies, we're spirit, soul. Once someone has understood that, then it's not something to be ignored. But your life has to take this into account, that real purposeful work should be to get to better next life, to avoid the great fall down. Fall into lower species. And rather to achieve the best life, which is liberation. Dharma, moksha, artha. The dharma, artha, kama, moksha. Four activities described in the Vedas. One can perform religious activities, meaning religion for material benefit. One can then forget the religious side and just do the material benefit, which is more modern approach. straight for the economic development. And then why do such things? Because of the next goal, kama, or material desire, to satisfy senses and different material desires. Those three, they're called trivargika, the three paths of material life. And most human beings are engaged in those activities only. But the fourth activity is called moksha, liberation. That means liberation from repeated birth and death. And then even beyond liberation is bhakti, or devotional service. So at least one has to come to the point of understanding that the trivargika, material temporary activities, are not my whole goal of life. Now, because we come to this material world, we have these particular bodies, we have to work. Everyone has to perform these activities, and because of our karma, we cannot simply avoid them. But they should be done in such a way that the main goal of life is not forgotten. This is the real art of living. It's not that Narada is condemning a certain kind of lifestyle for some arbitrary or religious idea which is unreasonable or which is a kind of arbitrary thing. One could say, well, he is a monk, he's a sannyasi, he may like that kind of life. But that doesn't mean for everyone that's the best way to realize yourself or to realize God. And that's true. But it's not that by being a celibate sannyasi, one is going to develop love of God, and that by being a householder, one is not going to develop love of God. So he's not talking like that, one style of life for no reason is better than another. But the dangers are pointed out in this particular verse of a life where a person gets completely occupied only by these things and forgets that they are temporary and there is something more than this. There is something more than raising the family, than earning a living, to do that and maintain it. And all the corollary activities that come from that, such as wanting some prestige for doing that, and different kinds of pride. So this is the danger, that one can forget he has another purpose on this planet, in this human form of life, which is to realize himself, aside from his temporary bodily identity as man or woman or whatever we have in this bodily identity. This is Narada's statement. And in the purport, Prabhupada refers to a similar statement made by Prahlad Maharaj. As Narada was a sannyasi, Prahlad Maharaj was a householder. He was a young boy when we hear him speak the wisdom to his father. It was referred to here. But he grew up to be a king, Vihasta. So he also, however, he's one of the Mahajans. He speaks the same message. Verse referred to here is when Prahlad spoke to his father, Tat Sarumanye Suravaryadehina Sadasumadrikim Dhyan Satvihat. His father asked him, what is the best thing you learned in school, Prahlad? And he came out with this astounding his father answer. His father had put him in the care of teachers who were teaching him politics. Being an expert in diplomacy, Radhikashipu, the father, expected his son to say some appreciation of those topics. But he came out and said, my dear, best of the atheists, father, the best thing I understand from my teachings, from what I've learned from the Guru, is that if you are in Grihastha life, or didn't say Grihastha, Griha, Griha Medhi, is actually reference into. You're engaged in materialistic household life and suffering as a result of that, just like a person who's fallen into a well, then you should get out of it by going to the vana or the forest. Similar. Because the miseries, they're not just for this type of life, for this one lifetime, but they will be perpetuated, and often, in order to do this kind of activity, we commit illegal and sinful activity, immoral activity, to justify it as making a living or something we have to do. And then you may not even get to the human life. Step in the long journey of the soul in different species of life. Prahlad says, go to the vana, the forest. What shall I do with the forest? The vana actually doesn't mean literally that you should have to go into the woods or the forest, but it's actually a reference to the vanaprastha order of life. In Vedic society, people follow different social and spiritual orders. And the spiritual orders, which are followed throughout a human life, are first being a celibate student, brahmachari, then being grihastha, getting married. Then that period goes on for, roughly speaking, 25 to 55. Then one should consider, both husband and wife, that we've done the best we could to raise a family and Krishna consciousness. Now, by God's grace, whatever we have, we have. Let us concentrate more fully now on our spiritual life and diminish our involvement in everything else. But when they do that, sometimes the husband and wife actually leave family and travel to holy places, make their partnership, which already should have been based on spiritual mutual benefit, one which is more clearly and uncompromisingly done just for that. So they both more or less become renounced persons, although living as husband and wife. And that's called vanaprastha, because traditionally they did go to the woods and live there and practice austerities, or go to the mountains, and the Himalaya mountains or by the Ganges, and live like ascetics. But that's not recommended in this age. In fact, in that Prahlad teaching, Prabhupada, he deals with the word vana, forest, and he says he takes it as Vrindavan. Vrindavan, that's another vana. Vrindavana is the special abode of Krishna on this earth where Krishna appeared. It's Vrindavan. And so, why not go to Vrindavan? And just like Lord Nityananda, he taught the very elderly Krishnadas Kaviraj in a dream, he said, my dear Krishnadas, go to Vrindavan, and there you will attain all your desires. So Prabhupada invites elderly people to go to Vrindavan, to just chant Hare Krishna and live simply in the temple of Krishna Balaram. Again, that also doesn't have to be taken literally, but the spirit of it, to live as if in Vrindavan and wind down the involvement in the other activity. Otherwise, you'll miss the real purpose of human life. Then, Prabhupada refers to another verse, Brahmanda Brahmete Kona Bhagyavan Jeev, how and which emphasizes that we're all wandering, birth after birth. There are many different examples been given to visualize this for us. Sometimes it's living in people described as like logs going down on a river, which are helplessly carried along. And, no help, no hope of stopping, getting out of that flow. And our comings together and certain combinations, like friends and family in a particular lifetime, they're just in really just inconsequential groupings that come together and then go apart. We come together for certain karmic relations, but we don't see that. We just see that this is my permanent, eternal combination, this family. This is who I am. I have no other identity. I'm the son of Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so. And then later I'm the husband of so-and-so. This is who I am. I work in such and such a place. But the Bhagavata describes that these identities or these combinations, they're just like sometimes in the water, some straws gather, bunch up, and then as the waves break, they go apart. Or another example is given as at a water hole, which is almost like you call a restaurant nowadays, where people gather to get water or people go into a restaurant. At every given moment in some other restaurant or every given hour, a certain group of people are there, have to be eating together, and then they're dispersed, different combinations. But those combinations are obviously chance, unrelated, and dispersed. So, but yet that other gathering, the family gathering, which lasts for a certain amount of years, is actually basically the same thing. Coming together and then, whether we like it or not, dispersed. And where do we go? Do we come together again? That no one knows. And this is called samsara. And we go on life after life, subject to many things that we do not want, like birth, death, disease, old age. But there is relief from all of these things if one gets transcendental knowledge. How to understand his relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead and how to transfer to the spiritual world where life is eternal, full of bliss and knowledge. Now, even while our mentality is still mixed up and we are still a part of this material world, not detached and not fully enlightened, Krishna consciousness can be practiced and we make gradual benefit. So that's done by the guidance of sage like Narada, who's coming to this king, the king Kachinabharisha. And the sages, they're compassionate, they're also intelligent enough to understand that people can't just give everything up and go to Nirvana. So they give very nice prescriptions how you can do your activities in this world but gradually purify yourself, calculate it in such a way that by the end of the life you'll be completely detached and develop love of God. Like we're describing work. So work is never, we're never told to give up work. But Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Yagnartha kamano yatra loko yam kamabandhanam tadartham kamakamteya mukta samatramachara. Work has to be done. But do your work in such a way that it is yajna, or sacrifice to the Supreme Lord Vishnu. Then the work won't entangle you. Because when we do things that aren't related to Krishna, then we get a different, we get karma from it. And that karma means you definitely have to take another life. If you ask what is karma and what is free of karma, everything is karma that we do, whether it's a bad thing, popularly called bad karma, or good karma. It's all material act which will result in a reaction, which either comes in this life or next life. It's like, say, dietary. If you eat bad foods, then fairly soon you start getting reaction. And they say if you eat good foods, you get good reaction. You have health, strength, and more duration. But there's nothing eternal about that. So that that activity of good karma might mean, in terms of next life, that you would get a better next body. But still, even with good physical health, or working for good physical health, it may also be in your karma to have some tragedy that just counteracts it. So many people have good health, and then they get some other fatal disease that attacks them in a different way. But normal good health, and then maybe hit by a car or hit by something. So the karma is so complicated, and there's no way out of it. So we have to do activities which have no karma to them at all, which are transcendental to good activities and bad activities. And that's called the transcendental life, doing things in devotional service to Krishna. So, speaking of eating, if the food that we eat is offered to Krishna, if we eat only sanctified foods, then it's a spiritual act. Wife and sons and occupational duty, but don't engage in the Kuta Dharma issue, in the false duties, which means that they have no Krishna conscious content to them. But let them all be engaged in the service of the Lord. How could this be done? Taking these same examples, the husband and wife, rather than coming together for sense gratification or material goals, they help each other as friends, or as husband and wife, for mutual spiritual development. And their children, they raise their children thinking, this is a spirit soul who's come into our household, and not that we produce them just by our union, but this soul also is eternal soul, has come into our home by the karma. Let us help this child to grow up and give it every opportunity that it can be liberated from birth and death. Then you've got a wonderful spiritual responsibility instead of an entanglement like a blind well. It's not the child that's bad or the wife or husband, but the entanglement. And the searching after wealth, the work itself, if the family is engaged in spiritual activities, then the maintenance of that family is also purified, and one should not exaggerate or overdo the desire to become very, very wealthy or to engage in ubra karma. Ubra karma means a particular kind of work which is very hard on the spirit, soul, and the body and the mind, and very degraded work. Or work that rules out any spiritual life, so that one is helpless. These things should be avoided, and the household life should be reformed. So I'll read the verse again, and if there's any questions or comments. Those who are interested only in so-called beautiful life, namely remaining as a householder entangled by sons and wife, searching after wealth, think that such things are life's ultimate goal. Such people simply wander in different types of bodies throughout this material existence without finding out the ultimate goal of life. Thank you. it's like anything in our spiritual life, whatever our position is, that we constantly need to progress and to rejuvenate our situation. Or, like you say, so-called realization of the truth becomes ineffectual. It's like an impotent realization. A realization or knowledge, it should really direct us in a certain goal, in a certain way. Our consciousness should be formed in that way. So if what you're describing happens too much, then that's really, we can become either like a hypocrite or that we know something and we're doing it differently than we say. Or, this kind of a thing that's always happens. We always have to be trying to improve and move forward to make these doctrines realities in our life. So if the specific thing you're saying is that someone is engaged in temporary activities and he knows his energy should be going into something higher, but he justifies it. But more than just like mentally justifying it, we suggest that there are ways to more and more spiritualize it. Like if you think out, well, Bhagavatam says that we shouldn't get involved in searching after wealth. Maybe I should just give up this whole thing. Why am I going to this job? Why am I making money and maintaining an apartment or house? Just give it up. And you think, well, no, I couldn't do that because of my personal limitations or my previous decisions and my commitments already. I have to do this. This is actually my religious duty to do this. I just have to do it in the right way now. It may not be that you may be being too hard on yourself. It may not be that it actually is that you're engaged in material temporary activities. They are spiritual because you are doing them for Krishna. If you're not, then correct it. And if it is being done for Krishna, then take heart in it that this is your particular dharma. That was with the Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. He had a misconception of his religious duty. He said, Krishna, I don't think I should be on the battlefield and fighting. I want to be a spiritual person. And Krishna said, no, for you to be a spiritual person, this is your dharma. You have to be on this battlefield because I want you to do it. So, similarly, we can't give up the battlefield. And it may be that partly by our own choice, by Krishna's arrangement, providence, we have a particular duty, and then we have to just spiritualize. Now, Krishna didn't say to Arjuna, you're a Kshatriya, so you can be greedy and you conquer the enemy and enjoy the kingdom. Go ahead. No. He had in mind that he should be a religious ruler and rule for everyone's benefit and be Krishna conscious. So, but not to give up that path of Kshatriya. We have to find out what we are, what we're supposed to do, and then don't think that it's not spiritual, but make it spiritual. Somebody may think that, oh, he's a karmi. He says he's a devotee, but he's actually just a food of worker. But he'll say, no, you're mistaken. I am doing this for Krishna. Then you just have to try to make it so by intensifying your spiritual practices and your commitments. So that can happen not only because of your husband, but again, it can happen for the renounced brahmacharya sannyasis, they could be in a temple, they could fall into that same mentality and just not really be vitally Krishna conscious, just be part of an institution. And they might think, well, where's my vital spiritual life? Well, there's nothing wrong with living in the temple and being renounced. It's a great place for spiritual advancement. So don't lose heart. Just do it. Do what your duty here. Starting with your own spiritual development. And then take up active service as part of this temple life or this renounced order. That could happen. It can happen. It does happen to all of us. But once we've got the some serious commitments and some serious orders to do a particular duty, then the way out of the entanglement is not to throw it aside and try to be something else. To do the duty, as Krishna says, without lethargy, without false ego, remember me and fight or do your duty. Some of the examples you gave, we start to get the impression that it's actually very hard to have a karma-free situation. So someone had a t-shirt, just like they have these nuclear-free zone. Someone had, this is a karma-free zone. But to actually be karma-free, very difficult, and more or less impossible. To be free of all those traces in Kali Yuga. I remember reading a book about, which advocated vegetarianism, and advocated it very strongly to the point that you shouldn't wear clothes like leather, things like that. But it also showed that to really get free of it is impossible, almost. It pointed out things like if you grow your flowers with the mind, the bones, the animals in it, to help the flowers grow. And of course on your automobile, the rubber tires, there's some animal product involved with them, and the buttons on the shirt. So that doesn't mean that some jobs are not worse than others. To be to work in the slaughterhouse, to be closely associated with the meat eating and the slaughter of animals, that we should avoid. So there are different persons. I can think of some practical examples. I know a doctor in Washington, D.C. Both he and his wife are doctors. And he's a woman's doctor. And so in his practice, he used to perform abortions, and it was a large part of his practice. So then when he became a serious devotee, he stopped that. And there was some financial considerations involved, but he did it, and he's still wealthy. But he's a doctor who won't give an abortion, so it's really convenient, I guess, for a customer who wants to go to him for other things, but has to go to another doctor just to do that. But he's taken that stand. Then there's a girl, a college girl, also in that area, who is majoring in biology, and then she had to dissect the animals. So I think these are personal decisions, not so much that somebody has to tell somebody how to live their life. But when she understood the different implications for herself, she changed her major to another medical chemical. I forget what it was exactly that she changed. Well, she didn't have to do that. Now, in some cases, best they can, and try and maybe try to gradually stop something when you get the realization or the opportunity. Now, going back to the point that every occupation has faults, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that every occupation has faults, just like in fire, there's always some smoke. But you shouldn't give up your occupation because of that fault. The examples are given that a businessman, inevitably, he does some kind of, can't think of a more polite word than lying, exaggerating maybe that this product is definitely this or definitely that. Or, as the example Prabhupada used, for you, I am not making any profit on this. So they say these things. But he shouldn't stop being a businessman just because he has to never be doing things like that. It shouldn't be illegal or actually corrupt. But don't give up being a businessman if that's your duty, just because there are some imperfections and moral flaws in that work. And then the Kshatriya, or the military person, he kills, which is a great sin. But if he's a military man, then for the country and for the cause, he has to do that. Now the Brahmin's duty is different. The Brahmin doesn't kill. But in the olden days, they used to perform yogis where they would divide the animals. Shouldn't give up his duty, that's the point in that section of Bhagavad Gita. Then Krishna says emphatically, to give up your duty, perhaps because you think there's an imperfection there, and to do another person's duty, that's worse, but that's the worst thing you can do. Do your duty. So we have to do our duty, but then when we get down to, well, what if my duty is to break the rules and regulations of spiritual life? Say, you know, as far as possible, find an occupation that will be clear of that. And so, those who are spiritually minded, they tend to look for occupation like that, or clean their occupation, and work, and their consciences are always. The only way to ultimately become free of implication is to do your service as service for Krishna. Then the impurities that are there, they will be removed by offering it to God. That's the basic outline. And then an individual, according to his strength, he has to act. One time, someone wrote a letter to Srila Prabhupada and said, I'm becoming interested in Krishna consciousness, I'm starting to chant Hare Krishna, but but I don't have a very good occupation. I work in a restaurant, and sometimes I have to prepare a meat. So what should I do? And Prabhupada didn't say what you should do, although according to the scriptures, we know one shouldn't do that. He said, he emphasized, responded to the positive, is, I'm very glad to hear that you're chanting Hare Krishna. Go on doing that, and Krishna is in your heart. He will tell you what to do about your occupation. So you may say, well, why didn't Srila Prabhupada just tell him to quit the job? Well, that's a man's business in one sense, that he has to quit the job if he's going to. He has to take the spiritual life if he's going to. He has to understand that, how can I be involved in this? But then he has to face the practical repercussions about, well, where's my other job? What other job will I take, and how much money will I get? So we can tell you what should be done, as in anything. And then we have, then it's up to us to take the first class or second class way. Possible, but equally or even more important is that it be utilized as service to the Lord. Otherwise, if you have a very so-called clean occupation, or an organic farmer or whatever, but there's no God consciousness involved, then what's the benefit? You have good karma.
That would seem to be like a really vital method for a devotee to decide his occupation and duty. But in the course of our talk, presenting Krishna consciousness, we're also talking about society and occupation and duty in general. And people pick up on that they were listening. And so they might say that their point about that someone's occupation and duty is as a soldier. And like Father goes to the example of a soldier killing. He doesn't do any wrong if he's acting under instruction. So in other words, a soldier is trained to kill, that's his business. But is it possible to present that that's an actual occupational duty in this age when governments aren't Krishna conscious, when they're instructing soldiers to, like an army is sent in somewhere for political reasons, people were just killed in China, for instance, or in Latin America, some gross outrage. Now, it would seem that they're saying that, well, it's their occupation is to solve to kill. But then Prabhupada has also said that in this age, everyone is born as less than a shooter, so there aren't any chapters with that occupation of duty. So how can we...
Well, you're answering it. That those who are Krishna conscious workers or creatures, we want our duty is to enlighten people about Krishna consciousness, and we would foresee, we would look for such a transformation that people would all become God conscious, and then things could work in society. In other words, in the setting in the Bhagavad Gita, there was a war. In other words, there is a time when there can be such action against aggressors, raiders, people who, the word kshatriya means who protects from hurt. You protect the children, the elderly, the Brahmins, and women, and protect the whole society so it can be peaceful. So because there are aggressors, there are occasions when defense is justified. It's not like there's an absolute material pacifism, but that can only be under the order of the Lord. So as you pointed out, nowadays, without that order, the military arms are just like demoniac forces. So that's not sanctioned by the Bhagavad Gita. All my occupation is to kill mercenary soldiers or government tool of oppression.
society that if you figure it out, we're saying, well, a few people are saying there shouldn't be intoxication. What are the implications of that? Is that just for a few of your members? Well, of course, it's not like a political thing by force, but if Krishna conscious propaganda became effective, then there wouldn't be any intoxication. So yes, there would be liquor stores, there would be slaughterhouses. These are the implications. But our work is just to try to enlighten people and so they can make individual choices. Probably you've been in a very bad situation. Even if we take it that when you're distributing books, effective book distribution is to get books out, so that you do as many books as possible to people who you think are going to read them. That may be a good definition of effective book distribution. We just say the more you do, that may not be good. Because I mean, like it used to be in the high competitive days, to figure out a way to make money somewhere else and throw Bhagavatams in people's cars. So, say that more books distributed to people who seem to be interested to read them. Well, that seems to be the extent of your responsibility. So then maybe that would be a strategy to try to approach people who you think would take the book, but they don't have to be young men or young women. Distribution is just one aspect of preaching. Try to approach a person who doesn't seem like he or she would take a book, but by your preaching they do. Prabhupada, he seemed to, well, young people were receptive to this one. But it's for everyone, old and young and rich and poor. Now, your other question, which is, should we think that, well, this person will not only will take a book and be interested, but he may give up all his activities and come and be willing to live in Krishna consciousness? Maybe you really shouldn't assume that you can figure all that out. In any way, that's not our goal. We'd be very happy if somebody took a book and started practicing Krishna consciousness. Never dreamed that they were not as a result of shaving their head or holding them in the temple. But they became very advanced Krishna conscious on their own. You have to think just of the one of the devotees means so often somebody may, a young person may move into a temple and a few years later gone. As I say, book distribution is perhaps the most important. There's one aspect only, and it's not like you're responsible for the complete follow-up of that person. As you give that person that book, that's it. You give them the book. Then next, other kind of preaching, which could be done by the same person, just follow up on that person. Did you get the book? Are you reading it? And then it does not mean, therefore, you have to move to the temple. I just got a letter from a person yesterday. man, he wants to become a devotee. He said he was associated with one of the temples. And it was a big temple, too, he said. And actually, he felt he wasn't treated so well. And then he came to Belfast for a while. And he was working with the youth schools. And he said in Belfast, he got on real well with the devotees because it was a smaller temple. But in this big temple in America, he said, when he would go to the temple, people were interested in him, and he sat down with him and helped him and everything. And then at some point, when they saw that they wasn't going to move to the temple, they were no longer interested in him. Very disappointed. So that's not very Christian conscious to think that somebody. That, he said, I couldn't convince him that I was serious about Christian conscience, that I was actually practicing Christian conscience. But he said maybe it was my fault that I was too shy or something, but still all they wanted to know was how to do it. Those who do take part in the temple, and they're trying to provide for that city or place different programs where people can associate with devotees and get enlivened, to either join that temple or to practice in the home. The temple serves people who live in it as well as people who live in that city by making festivals, making books available. Both in household life and to a person who falls into a well. Sometimes it's said a covered well. So in India there are a lot of covered wells. Like grass grows over them. And so sometimes a person falls in the well and is so removed from any place. He calls and nobody hears them. So they said, well, why would you say that materialistic householder life is like that? I think because it doesn't appear that you're in prison. You have a wife and you have a house and you have a job. And then so maybe you're complaining, oh, this is terrible. I want to get out of this. I'm suffering so much. So your people in general say, well, what are you crying about? You got yourself in that situation. And that kind of no response to your call. I think it like that, then, because apparently he's doing what he wants to do, or what he got himself into. So who's going to hear your call of help? Like if somebody is being beaten up on the street and he's calling help, help, and it's, everyone looks up, oh, look, poor man, he's being beaten. But if someone is in his householder life. But then inwardly he realizes, I'm trapped. I have no spiritual life. I'm just working to support this family and support this house. I have no spiritual life. And he goes out in the street or somewhere and starts complaining like that. What's your problem? That would be like that. But at any rate, it does describe what could happen to a person who falls into a covered well. Yeah, he'll respond. Yeah. Just like somebody in the covered well, somebody may hear him and come to him. Therefore, in the next paragraph, it says that One may wander through the Brahmande Purnabhagya Vandiv. One may wander birth after birth and not be helped and not be saved. But some person who's very fortunate, someone will come to him, like Narada came, and will try to help him. But in most situations, people are not seen. Either they are crying and nobody's coming to them with the right medicine, or they're not even crying. But yes, the devotee, either the person is enjoying and the devotee will come to him and say, oh, you poor man, you're in a household life, or you're in a terrible situation. And then they'll say, well, don't bother me, I'm doing all right. Or even if they're suffering, you may come to them, they may not want our remedy. But the devotee will come. As Prabhupada says, it's the duty of saintly persons to try to instruct illusion persons about the goal of life and save them from the entanglement of karma bandha. So it's just an example. Sometimes just in a joking way, Krishna conscious household, they say, oh, I'm in the dark well. But they shouldn't really even be in the dark well or think of themselves like that. It's just kind of, I take it as kind of a humble joke or something to do like that. Yes? Like a very difficult decision to make. I answered in general in answer to his question. We always try to think of things that our spiritual masters, Srila Prabhupada, told us about particular things. I can't think of his answering a question like that. He was in favor of the human so-called mercy killing. I remember there were some conversations and they would describe that to Prabhupada and he would say, you may conceive of it as mercy, but if I don't want it, if I don't conceive of it as mercy, just in general, I can't remember where he exactly said it, but my question is, he didn't favor the human mercy killing or any extraordinary attempts to interfere with nature's way. So it's he regarded it sort of sarcastically that you're such a big helper, such a meddler, you're coming to kill. You take this as a great service that you're killing. But in other words, nature's business to kill. And we can try to preserve life. And even that we shouldn't do by extraordinary methods of hospitalization to make a person live another 5 days. Being all hooked up and everything. Just develop your spiritual life and your simple material life, and then nature will take its way to give us a certain duration and to finish us as we're meant to be in this body, finished at a certain time. So the non-violence principle supposed to extend from the humans to the animals also. sense it would be easy if it was something like I mentioned, that that doctor who had a practice that wasn't based just on that, just on abortion. So he limited the abortion part of his practice, and his practice went on nicely. But I don't know if it's such a, if it's just an in, like, in the, like you go to certain persons and they do a lot of services, and maybe they don't have a certain service. I love animals, I don't kill them. Well, that even, that's also, because they won't kill the granny, but I was reading the recent article in the Telegraph in London about the lost art of dying, and how it used to be that people would die at home, and now 75% of people die in hospitals. And the reason is that people, they can't grasp death, they don't want to be near it, they just want to get rid of it, they're afraid of seeing somebody die. So that some of that may be there in the animal. They like the pet, but as soon as the pet is just dragging around and coughing and everything, get it out of there. It's not nice anymore. If they really love the pet, that would also be incomprehensible to them. They should be so loving that they just, like at our farm in Pennsylvania, we have cows, and a lot of the cows are dying of old age. We've had them for quite a while. And so, I was just visiting there, and it was raining for several weeks, actually. But this one cow started to die. And once they sit down, they don't get up anymore. That's a sign that they're ready to die. So they put a tent around the cow, and they would go to see the cow, because we have a special affection. And it was like a decent way. And then one day, the cow, that particular cow, just put her head down and died. So that's a real humane way to treat the animals. I know it's an easy thing to sit here and pontificate about it. There are very ticklish situations where there's a lot of pain involved and everything. I really couldn't, I wouldn't want to assume, I guess you have to, you can't avoid that with your conscience, thinking about and the practical considerations. If you don't do that, what it might do to you. You sympathize with that too, but it seems like a very difficult thing to have to do once you become more aware of your responsibility to be a compassionate person and to not be involved in violence and killing.
She's not going to do it, and she's not used to it, and all this stuff. So it's a very different.
Well, yeah.
The honor of John, and she refused that. Last, and the other thing she will.
Well, that's a significant distinction that
yeah.
you've made, that that she won't do these sort of whimsical
putting down. No. And even if any hope you can ask if you have one at the moment.
So that sometimes a person will come in and say, please put this animal down, and you'll say, no, we won't do it.
It's not possible. We think there's any hope at all. But if it's gasping, sort of, it's nice to see the pain, maybe emotions. It's not there to say, look, to be honest, you know, I don't want to leave them if I see the animal put down. If one of you would say, sorry, I won't do it, that person
yeah.
would go up and they would definitely broadcast a high in mind. Don't
yeah.
go near that woman. She's a,
yes.
She's savage. She's cool.
Well, I think you're already on a good platform then of refusing the whimsical ones and only doing the ones you feel are absolutely necessary.
This is it. And then, like you said earlier on, if you offer it to Krishna to say, look, I'm doing it for the right reasons, I believe. You know, what Angela feels is that this is part of its karma, and it's bad karma, and it has to suffer out that, and then she takes its life hours before it goes, maybe days. It has to come back again and work that off.
Well,
but it has to come back anyway, because if it's an animal, it has to get up there.
I would think it would be more in what I was talking about, the imperfection in any work, rather than try to transform it into a religious act.
Yeah.
Just say, well, this is, we all have some dirty work,
exactly.
But we have
that's
to do
why it. I see it in the sense like you do it from absolute kindness and
yeah.
absolute mercy. And indeed, in Angela's practice again, she's not one of these people that's in it for material gain. Quite a number of the animals that she does prolong their life, it's at her own cost. That people say, look, right, I want to put it down on an animal that's about 40 pounds. She makes it 50 pounds to keep it alive, but they won't give any more. So
yeah.
she's not doing it for any gain like that. She's just trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Now, that then it doesn't stop there, unfortunately. How do you treat antibiotics and things? They're putting down, they're described like
therefore the only way to become free of these things is to do all that you do as an offering to Krishna. There are some religious sects who they go to extremes in the worldly sense of trying to not commit any violence, like the Jains. They wear masks. So they won't breathe in too many living beings. And they walk, some of them, with a broom, brushing the living entities. But although those extremes are taken, they still don't, they still commit violence, because that's what it is to live in this world. In the Vedas are mentioned five kinds of unintentional violence that are committed, that we inadvertently do just by living. So you have to do different acts to purify yourself from the inevitable violent acts that we commit, rather than think that it's possible to actually be a nonviolent being. That you have to be as nonviolent as possible. Then for the violence that you do commit, you have to perform some kind of purifying activity, chanting the holy name and doing everything you can for the good of the world and for God consciousness. Both things have to be done. And it seems like you're making a very conscientious effort already to do that by only doing it when it's absolutely necessary. And then if Krishna has in plan for you something further than that, that may be revealed in time. It's not up to us, in other words. We're not in control of our whole destiny. You may just change things around.
Possibly a way out of it may be that any profits or gains that specifically attached to that one particular thing, as opposed to something else. Now, your government is completely right, you put in your own kidney, but if you give it to the same person, if I have to put something down like that, that goes Krishna, like put it towards the service of Krishna or something like that, donate it for that sort of help as well.
That would be a good general policy.
Yeah,
I don't know that it has to be applied just to that act.
Yeah.
He gets the dirty money. It's a good point. But why just restricted to that?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I'm only just saying that it proves the question is out here now.
Said that like every endeavor is covered by a thought, and that the various occupations that there is something going along with them. And that would emphasize the point you made that at the age you'd be looking towards a later stage of mind where we give up these occupations.
Yeah. In every person's career, what was stated in the verse, what he's referring to is that whatever your occupation was, at the time when even our secular society speaks of retirement, they usually think of retirement as just another kind of material enjoyment that you take up. But one should look forward to that as a time to intensify spiritual practices, and that would include becoming free from whatever inevitable karma I did incur during my working days and my involvement in the world where I had to do certain things I didn't really want to do. Now I should do, as some part of a life at least, I should do things that are, as far as possible, not at all involving materialistic and sinful reactions. That's another part of the program. Testing laboratory, and for the federal government in the United States, and there was some cruelty to animals involved, but he managed to get it passed out of his department, he didn't do it, but it was going to be done, someone was going to do these things, but perhaps in that case, he managed that somebody else do it, not himself. And it seemed like he did then free himself from...
Yeah, but it was in fact really just got out.
Yeah.
And they heard what we wanted directly.
Yeah.
Really like saying,
yeah,
I want somebody bumped off.
Yeah.
I don't want to do it because of being said, so I'll pay you to do it because it's really the same thing.
Right.
See, the problem is, if supposedly Angela decided to quit the vet totally because of that, and then every vet decided to close me all again.
But they won't.
But if they did, and then doctors, you'd have no beds, no doctors, any of them are real. They are necessary. It's the mind.
Yeah.
And Angela's one of the better ones, one of the kinder ones.
Uh-huh.
Because there are some desperate, you know, savages in the business. They literally bring the negative down with that. They don't mind. It's for the money. They're not worried. And, you want to try and keep them on
their own. That's true, yeah.
There's such a thing as Krishna conscious. There's also such a thing as animal conscious.
Oh yeah.
Trying to be do the best you can for them. So you want to try and keep the benefit in the professions and all professions for that matter.
That's true.
So the thing is, it's not really the answer I think for some. I think the thing to do is to cut it to the bare minimum.
Yeah.
Of
nowadays they're justifying so many things.
I
remember when I was a child, I asked my father, why do we have to kill the animals? Well, if we didn't kill them, they would overrun the planet.
That's right.
So I just accepted it. But then you find out these things is not the way.
Specifically, the other thing that's often badly done is individual consciousness. I speak to you in the United States, not just here in the Americas, but I suppose I've started with that here in Ireland. I've met people with consciousness that would love to do anything.
And if that's the criteria. Right. We've lost our conscience. But that Narada Muni, there's one example. He met a hunter in the woods who would half kill animals and leave them in pain. It was just a converted mentality. So Narada asked him, why do you do this? He said, my father taught me to do this. I don't see anything wrong. Rather, when I do it, it gives me great pleasure. So there was no conscience.
No conscience. No.
But then after Narada instructed him and told him the dangerous implications, then he had a conscience. Had to be instructed.
Unless you're a naturally or a highly sensitive person, your conscience really is really a product of your environment. I mean, if your father is what you're probably going to watch your own.
Yeah. We can give the animals some Krishna prasadam,
something.